Okay, tonight I'd like to pick up where we left off in the book of Acts. We left off in chapter 23. And if you remember in chapter 22, Paul, he gets down to Jerusalem and he's there less than 2 weeks and a whole riot breaks out. You know, people are just trying to literally kill him, beat him to death. And then the Roman centurion comes in and breaks up this big riot, rescues him from the grip of these religious fanatics who were just out to murder him. And next thing you know, when everything calms down, this Roman centurion decides, okay, now that everybody's had a time to just give themselves a little breathing room and count to 10 before they do something rash, the next day he got together the elders, or excuse me, the religious leaders who were so hostile towards Paul. And he brought Paul in their midst, and he figured, okay, he wanted to know what is the problem. So Paul basically is now going to stand trial before these religious leaders, beginning in this chapter 23. Just read the last verse of chapter 22 as we go into 23, so you get an idea of what I'm talking about here. It says, but on the next day, wishing to know for certain why he, Paul, had been accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priest and all the council to assemble and brought Paul down and set him before them. Chapter 23, verse 1, it says, and Paul, looking intently at the council, said, brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. And a high priest, Ananias, commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. And do you sit and try me according to the law, and in violation of the law order me to be struck? But the bystander said, do you revile a God's high priest? And Paul said, I was not aware, brethren, that he was a high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. And perceiving that one part were Sadducees and the other part Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, brethren, I am a Pharisee, son of a Pharisee, and I am on trial for the hope and the resurrection of the dead. Now, before we go any further, okay, what's happening here, he's brought down, the centurion brings him down, he's in the middle of this, basically a trial, you know, a tribunal or a council or whatever, and the centurion wants to find out exactly what the problem is here. So Paul starts out with his defense, and he says, brethren, I've lived my life with a perfectly good conscience up to this point. And the high priest says, strike him on the mouth. And I, you know, I have to just shake my head, because it's like, what's happening here? I mean, you got to almost back up to the words of Jesus where he said, hey, no student is greater than his teacher, and no slave or servant is better than his master. If they persecute me, they're going to persecute you. If they hated me, they're going to hate you. And basically, that he says that, you know, this is what's going to happen to his followers. And it's kind of like you look at Paul and his life and some of the things that he's gone through, and you see some real parallels between his experiences and that of Jesus, where Paul is on trial here, and just like with Jesus, was slapped or struck during his trial. Paul is going to be struck in the middle of this courtroom, basically. I mean, any fair-minded person would just kind of, it would raise a real red flag and just say, hey, this is a total miscarriage of justice. If, for example, if you went into a courtroom and you've got a defendant on the witness stand, and he says to the court, listen, you know, I'm innocent of this charge, and the judge says, hey, go to the bailiff, go slap that guy. I mean, what would you think of that kind of judge? What would you think of that kind of courtroom? I mean, wouldn't it, you shake your head and just say, this is an absolute miscarriage of justice. Well, this is what happened to Paul, and he says, hey, God is going to strike you, you whitewash wall, to the high priest. Now, Paul says here he didn't recognize it was the high priest. Now, I don't know, Paul's been gone away for several years, but this is Ananias, so I'm pretty sure that he would know that he was the high priest, unless he wasn't not in his high priestly robe, which I doubt if he was. That's probably more the case. There is a possibility that Paul's eyesight was pretty impaired, because if you read in Galatians and you read in other portions of Scriptures, there's a suggestion there that maybe through his beatings and his stonings that he had his vision was pretty much impaired. So he didn't realize who he was talking to or who he was talking about. But once he was told, well, this is the high priest, then he immediately retracted this, understanding that, hey, I'm not out here to be rebellious or arrogant or belligerent or anything like that. And he basically says that he made a mistake. Okay, he didn't realize who the man was. But if you look at what's happening to him, gosh, I shake my head and I say, isn't it something that people who claim to be standing for God can be so misled? They can be so zealous and yet so wrong. They can be so sincere yet right on their way to hell. I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard it over the course of over 30 years. People tell me, well, you know, it doesn't really matter what you believe as long as you are sincere. And I think that's one of the most asinine statements I've ever heard in my life. Have you? I mean, Hitler was very sincere, so was Stalin. And you look at these Muslims today, they're very, very sincere. Does that mean that they are right? Does that mean that they're on the way to heaven simply because the person is sincere? Believe me, all we have to do is look around us, and we can see a lot of people who are very sincere, yet they are so blinded to the truth. And this is no exception. We look at Paul's situation here, where he's being tried by religious zealots who really don't care about the truth. They just are out with a vindictive spirit to do away with this man, just like they were with Jesus. And then he says here, so Paul, being filled with the Spirit, he has a great deal of wisdom. He kind of like sizes up the whole group, and he realizes, hey, I'm going to pit these guys against each other because I don't stand a chance in this kind of courtroom where it's obviously justice and truth have no place here. So he looks around at verse 7 and he says, verse 6, and he says, but perceiving that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee, and I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead. And as he said this, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor an angel or a spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledged them all. And there arose a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, we find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. And as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also. And when it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. And there were more than 40 who formed this plot. And they came to the chief priest and the elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation, and we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. So the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. And Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him. So he took him and led him to the commander and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you, since he has something to tell you. And the commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, what is it that you have to report to me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council as though they were going to inquire something more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you. Therefore, the commander let the young man go, instructing him, tell no one what you have notified me of these things. And he called to him two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. They were also provided mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. And he wrote a letter having this form, Claudius Lysias to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came upon them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. and waiting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to the council and found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. And when I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. So the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. And when these had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. And when he had read it, he asked from what province he was. And when he had learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept on Herod's praetorium. I read this all the way through because basically as this plot unfolds, I think we get more of an idea of what's going on here. Because what's interesting to me is that you see how these people are just so hell-bent on destroying Paul that over 40 of them get themselves together and they bind themselves with an oath. Now, this oath that they're binding themselves by, they're swearing by the God of heaven that they're not going to let him live another day. They're not going to eat or drink until they have assassinated him or killed him in the name of God. And, of course, we see that happening all over the world today with these Islamic fanatics. They have the same kind of mindset that they just feel like, hey, they're doing God's will by going out and killing innocent people. Well, these people were no different. But I think it's kind of significant when you look at just the deceitfulness of the human heart and just how hypocritical it is. Because, first of all, these men have sworn by an oath, okay, they're not going to eat or drink anything until they kill him, until they carry this through. Well, through God's providence, Paul finds out about this, then the centurion finds out about this, and then he makes provisions to get Paul out of there safely. And I can't help but wonder in the back of my mind, well, I wonder how long these guys went without eating or drinking. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that after the first 2 or 3 days, they just, one by one began to make rationalizations or excuses, or they weren't telling the other person that they were breaking their oath or breaking their promise. But you see so much hypocrisy here, all in the name of religion. And isn't that a shame that this is what goes on all over the world, that people will, in the name of religion, do these, to me, it's just wicked things, evil things, sinful things. And the old adage to say, hey, the more things change, the more things remain the same. And I certainly see that happening today. I mean, we look back 2,000 years ago, we've seen the same kind of mindset that we see in so many people today who claim to be religious. Well, the reason is because human nature hasn't changed. Human nature, by its very essence, is evil. And our biggest problem today is people think that, well, man is basically good, but anybody who has any wisdom and insight and understanding can see that that is not the case. Man is basically evil, and he needs a new nature. He needs to be changed. Well, you can see that a man can be very, very religious and still very, very evil right down to his core, and that's what these men represented. They were going to kill an innocent man, and they even swore an oath to the God of heaven that they weren't going to eat or drink. Well, obviously, they broke that promise, right? Here's another thing. I mean, if you look at the rashness of what they said there, remember what Jesus said? He says, don't swear by heaven or by earth. He says, because heaven is, God's throne room and the earth is God's footstool. And he says, and don't swear by your own head because you don't even have the power to turn one of your hairs gray. He says, don't swear by Jerusalem because that's the city of the great king. He says, let your yeses be yes and your noes be no, because why? Anything more than that is what? It's from the evil one. And, this is how the devil can so often ensnare us with our own words. And, that's why Jesus said, don't be making rash promises. Don't be making oaths, this type of thing. Now, there are certain things that you do make. Certainly, there are wedding vows, and certainly there are other type of vows and other type of commitments that you need to make before God. But to make a rash oath is really of the devil. He's going to always turn that around and bring you under God's condemnation or judgment because of your tongue. And obviously these guys fell into the same, that kind of snare. And I think that if it tells us anything, is that, hey, let your yeses be yeses and your noes be noes. Don't make any rash promises, especially in the name of God, because you don't have that power to take your next breath apart from God. You know, I mean, Christians would be very, very foolish to say, hey, I swear to God, I'm going to tithe this much of my money to this particular organization, that particular church. Well, don't do that, because believe me, you can end up sinning doing something like that, even though your intentions may be good. I mean, you just got to come out and say, hey, if the Lord wills, I'm going to really try to tithe this much money to this particular church or Christian organization or outreach or missionary outreach or whatever. But don't be swearing about these things, because this is something that will always ensnare you, and that's what Jesus was talking about. So anyway, what happens here is that this Roman centurion, he protects Paul by putting together this 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. And he marches them up all night long. They go on a march from Jerusalem up to Caesarea, which is about 60 miles. So he brings them up there to the governor Felix, along with this note, to say, hey, man, I don't understand what the problem is with this guy, but he certainly hasn't broken any Roman laws. Apparently they have a lot of problems with him in regards to their own Jewish laws, so you decide this case. So anyway, that's as this story unfolds, I think that's what we begin to see here, is that God is protecting Paul. Remember what Jesus said to him at the beginning of this chapter? He says, hey, man, he appeared to him, stood by him, and it says in that verse 11 there, go back to that, it says, but on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at my side and said, take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness to Rome also. Now, here's the situation. Jesus is telling him, hey, I got work for you to do. I'm not done with you yet. Okay, these religious fanatics decide, we're going to kill this guy. We're not going to eat or drink till we do so. Well, you've heard me say this many times. If we are in God's perfect will, if it's not time for us to go, I don't care what happens. You are not going to die. You are immortal, literally, until, you know, it's your time to go, until God has decided, well, I'm going to take you home. That's the bottom line. In other words, we are immortal or invincible, or, you know, in terms of anything that the devil or the world can do to us, as long as we are in God's will and he has work for us to do. And that's what we see with Paul's situation. God made sure that Paul's nephew, it says here, is Paul's sister's son. So obviously Paul had a sister and it was his nephew. We don't know anything about his sister. Or his, basically his family, but you know, I can pretty well guess that she was a Christian, and Paul gets word of this plot. Well, that was all orchestrated by God, because God saved his life, spared him with this divine protection. So again, you know, I just feel like, hey, if we focus in on God's will and doing God's will, regardless of what the devil or the world or anybody else or enemies want to do to us, they can't take our life until it's God's timing. Anybody want to add or share to that chapter 23? I'd like to just quickly go through this chapter 24. It's only 27 verses, but it's a continuation of the story. I think there's a real spiritual lessons to be learned from it. Beginning with that verse 1 in chapter 24, it says, and after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and with a certain attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. And after Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. This is so typical to me of lawyer speak, and it's also so typical to me of religious hypocrisy. In other words, here the high priest comes down. He's got his attorney with him, and let's face it, the Jews hate the Romans, but look at the way they suck up to the Romans. I mean, it's just all meant to try to pervert the justice, or distort justice, or just simply to butter them up, you know, to kiss their rear end, to try to get them to rule in their favor. It's so typical to me of lawyer speak. There's no sincerity here at all, is there? I mean, I don't believe for 1 minute he really felt what he said here. And then he says here, in verse 4. It says, "But that I may not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing. For we have found this man a real pest and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world and a ringleader of the sects of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to desecrate the temple, and then we arrested him." And there's also a marginal note that says, "But Lysias, the commander, came along and with much violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you." And in verse 8 it says, "By examining him yourselves concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things which we have accused him." And the Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so. And when the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense." And this is the way Paul opens up his address to the governor. He just simply says, "Hey, knowing that you've been in your position for so many years, I'm confident that you're going to, render a fair verdict," is basically what he's saying here. He's not trying to butter him up. He's just simply stating a fact. He says, verse 11, since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship, and neither in the temple nor in the synagogues nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot, nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. But this I admit to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, and there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience before God and before men. Now, after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings, in which they found me occupied in the temple, having been purified without any crowd or uproar. But there were certain Jews from Asia who ought to have been present before you and to make accusations if they should have anything against me, or else let these men themselves tell what misdeeds they found when I stood before the council, other than for this one statement which I shouted out while standing among them. For the resurrection of the dead, I am on trial before you today." Now, this is Paul's argument. I think as it begins to unfold, I think he says an awful lot here, especially when he makes reference to the fact that he's on trial here for one reason, and that's because he basically believes in the resurrection of the dead. The way he describes it here, that verse 15, says, "Having hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience both before God and before men." To me, this is the meat of this chapter 26, is what he says here, that there is going to come a day where there's going to be a resurrection of the righteous and the wicked. I mean, if you stop and consider it, stop and reflect upon that one statement for just a minute. I mean, to me, that is an awesome statement. I mean, we can read it and let it go right over our heads, or we can look at it and really reflect upon, what does that mean? There is coming a day when there's going to be a resurrection, and not just of the righteous, but of the wicked. And the Bible makes it abundantly clear, from the Old Testament to the New Testament, and Jesus makes it abundantly clear himself, that there's coming a day when everyone who are in their graves, are going to hear his voice. That he's going to say, "Come forth." Just like he said, "Lazarus, come forth." He's going to say, "Come forth." He's going to say, "Come forth to the righteous," because they are going to have a separate resurrection from the resurrection of the damned. And the resurrection of the damned, Daniel describes it in such a way that I often reflect upon it. That's going to be the most awesome day in the universe. That's going to be a day that is just so terrifying for the unsaved. And, I oftentimes look at people who are just so arrogant and so full of themselves and so conceited. And a lot of times you can't debate with these people. You certainly can't argue with them, because it's like, to get their point across or to put you down, they raise their voice or the decibels of their voice and they're yelling and screaming and that type of thing. Well, on that day of the great white throne judgment, you're going to see these people standing naked before this all-consuming fire. And the way that Daniel describes it, he says that fire is flowing from this very throne room. It's flowing like lava. Fire is flowing from this very throne. And it's so dazzling white, this throne. And you see Christ sitting on his throne, and the sight is just, will strike terror into anyone. No one is going to dare be belligerent or obnoxious or in your face attitude. They're going to be standing there, you know, being overwhelmed with a sense of their own sinfulness. There's not going to be one person in that crowd who's going to think to themselves, well, I'm basically a good person. I don't belong here. They're going to be overwhelmed with the realization of their wickedness and their wretchedness and their sinfulness and their pettiness of everything from their selfish little sins to the gross flagrant rebellions against God. They're going to be so aware of this type of thing. And it's like when you stop and reflect upon that, it's like I work in a grocery store and every day I deal with hundreds of different people. I see hundreds of people every day. And the thought crosses my mind very often. I will see people that look very, very well dressed, very, very rich, very, very, you know, well to do, or you know, you could tell the way they carry themselves that they have a high education. You know, they're up there as far as the socioeconomic status is concerned. See other people that you could tell that they're very poor, they're very uneducated. I see a lot of old people. As a matter of fact, even just today, you know, I seen a lady come into the store that I've known for years from my other store. And, you know, I was just in passing. I says, well, where's the boss today? And she said, well, he died a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, of course, that's always a good thing to say. But, you know, it's like, since I've been there, this has happened to me twice. I said that to two different people at two different occasions. Well, you know, where's the boss today? Once was a guy, and I was just talking about referring to his wife, because I used to see him all the time, talk to him all the time in the store. And he told me, well, she passed away Thanksgiving Day. And today I just found another person that passed away. And, you know, of course you really feel, you know, bad for these people, and you feel, you know, because you've known them. But the thought just crossed my mind, you know, I don't know where that person is today, but they're going to be resurrected someday. They're either going to be in one group or the other. And when you read what Paul's saying here, he says here, I think that is so important, because he says, look at verse 15 and 16 again. It's the heart of this message, as far as I'm concerned, from this chapter 24. Having a hope in God, which these men cherish themselves, that there shall certainly be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience both before God and before men. I mean, when you have that in the back of your mind, that I'm going to have to stand before God someday and render an account to my life, then you got to strive to do what? To have a blameless conscience before God and before men. I mean, this is what people really need to have, as far as I'm concerned, foremost in their mind, is that I have to, you know, render an account someday to this all-consuming fire, and I'm going to be resurrected in one group or the other. And to me, there's no more solemn thought, as far as I'm concerned, than that realization that it's going to happen, whether people believe it or not. They certainly. Can you imagine the type of world this would be? I mean, just stop about for and think about it just for a minute. I mean, because I do this all the time. I just kind of, I guess, entertain myself with these kind of thoughts. But I think to myself, I read a verse like this, where Paul simply says, I do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience before God and before men. Can you imagine what the world would be like if everybody had that frame of mind to try to maintain a blameless conscience before God and before men? Can you imagine? Can you imagine what kind of world this would be to live in? I mean, if people really try to maintain a blameless conscience before God and before men, there wouldn't be any of this robbing and stealing and murdering and lying and cheating and conniving and the immorality and the idolatry and the arrogance and the in-your-face and the political and religious corruption. And I mean, the list goes on and on. You can go on all night of how inundated this world is with wickedness and with evil. Why? Because people as a whole do not live their lives with this kind of mindset of being blameless before God and before man. Now, we're all sinners. None of us are perfect. We're always going to fall. We're always going to sin. We're always going to fall short. But that's why we have Christ as our Savior. But at the same token, if we really lived our life with the attempt to be blameless before God and man, could you imagine what the world would be like? I mean, it would just be almost paradise. It would be, you know, heaven on earth. But unfortunately, people do not have that mindset, so this is the world we live in here.
Excuse me, what I don't understand with all of this. I know it's a spiritual thing, the stuff going on in Israel and stuff, but we're all people. I don't understand wars in general, because they're all, you know, children of some mother and all that stuff, but they take the spiritual hatred and go with that. But we're all people on earth. Can't we just get along?
Yeah, right. Well, Rodney King, yeah, right.
I know. The problem, that's who I was quoting.
But here the problem is, not only do we have a fallen nature, but we've got the devil that's behind so much of what goes on.
Most definitely.
I mean, and he's the one that pits one against the other so often.
Does it make sense otherwise?
No, it doesn't. Because the Bible says we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. It's not just, you know, one person against another person. Mm-hmm. It's the spiritual forces of wickedness that's behind that pushes people, you know, into hating one another and to killing one another, driving them. But they will use, you know, a person's fallen nature because it's so ready-made, it's so conducive to carry out this kind of thing, because people, by their very nature, are going to be, you know, selfish, self-centered, egotistical, proud, and whatever. And it's just the devil can take that and just stir it up and just pit one against the other. And I always think of what Paul says when he talks about us not wrestling with we're not wrestling with just flesh and blood, but he's talking about these spiritual forces of wickedness that are in heavenly places. Mm-hmm. When I first, you know, became a Christian, I used to read about that term, heavenly places. I used to think to myself, well, that must be that they're up there in the heavens conducting this warfare. And I've come to the realization that, you know what he really meant? When he's saying that they are these spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places, they are in high places on the earth. They are in politics. They are in the courtrooms. They are in, you know, they influence the judges and the lawyers and everybody who is in a high position. They are in our colleges. Look around and you look at what are they teaching in our colleges. You see all this godlessness and this immorality in our schools. You look at the high places in Hollywood, the entertainment industry. And so that's what it means in heavenly places. In high places, that's where they do their most work. And people don't realize it. So anyway, we kind of got off on a tangent here, but that's why, you know, people are at each other's throats, is because there's demonic influences that are behind it all. Behind the scenes. So anyway, what Paul's saying here in that verse 22, picking up, it says, but Felix, having more exact knowledge about the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias, the commander, comes down, I will decide your case. And he gave orders to the centurion for him to be kept in custody and yet have some freedom, and not to prevent any of his friends from ministering to him. But for some days, Felix arrived with Drusilla, his wife, who was a Jewess, and sent for Paul and heard him speak about the faith in Christ Jesus. And as he was discussing righteousness and self-control and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you. At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given to him by Paul. Therefore, he also used to send for him quite often to converse with him. But after 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Procus Festus, and wishing to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. Now, here, on a concluding note of this chapter 24, I think it's very, very instructive. It's Felix, he reminds me of a type of Herod. Mm-hmm. He's got a Jewish wife. He knows a lot about the Jewish law. He believes in God, obviously. But look what happens when he summons Paul, and Paul begins to witness to him. This is what Paul begins to talk about to him. He says in verse 25, and as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you. Mm-hmm. Well, when he finds time, he will summon him. There's no way that I could know for sure. But I'm telling you, if I was a betting man, I'd bet $1,000 that Felix is in hell tonight. Why? Because when he was confronted with the opportunity to make a decision about Christ, he procrastinated. He says, I'll hear this later on. Okay, he was frightened. In other words, he was convicted. Mm-hmm. There was a conviction there. I mean, 30 years ago, over 30 years ago, the night I accepted Jesus Christ, you know, I came out of this bar and somebody told me about Jesus Christ, and, you know, I came under conviction. I was scared that night. I went home and I thought, you know, I don't know, there really is a hell now. If I don't change my life, I'm going to go to hell. And that was convicting. And that night I knelt down and gave myself to Christ, got my life turned around and changed. Why? Because I came under conviction. I realized, hey, I got a choice here. I got to make a decision here. And God gave me the good grace that I needed to make the right decision. But Felix is in that same situation, but he procrastinates. He puts it off. Well, I'll summon you at a different time. How many people are in hell tonight because they put it off? They procrastinate. They had the opportunity to make a choice, to make a decision, to turn their life around, and they says, well, you know, I'll get around to it. Well, if you look at this, what it's saying here, I think it's very, very instructive, because he says he's discussing righteousness, self-control, and judgment to come. See, people, well, they have no discomfort whatsoever in speaking about religion. I have found this over the years, that people will gladly talk about religion in the abstract. They will talk about religious beliefs, or they'll talk about, I don't care, whether it be meditation, Eastern religion, or they can talk about religion from now to the crack of doom without feeling any discomfort whatsoever. But then you talk about Jesus Christ in the context of righteousness and self-control and judgment, and then the atmosphere becomes very, very tense. It becomes very, very uncomfortable, because people do not want to deal with this. They really don't. And it always amazed me, and you can be in a group of people that can talk about everything and anything, but mention Jesus Christ in that context, and all of a sudden there becomes a real spirit of uncomfortableness, doesn't it? If you're in a secular setting, that's what happens every single time. And that's what happened to Felix here. He's talking about righteousness. I mean, this is what we, you know, and when he's talking about righteousness, he's talking about righteousness from God's standard. We could talk about it from all day long about how good we are, but that's not righteousness. He's talking about God's righteousness. He's talking about self-control. I mean, self-control, do you even use that word today? Nowadays, you know, it says anything goes. If it feels good, do it. I mean, there is no self-control. When we talk about self-control, it's saying, hey, you got to abstain from things like fornication, homosexuality, and adultery, and all of these other types of things. You know, I don't care what it is, from drunkenness to gluttony, we're talking about self-control here, and people don't want to hear this. But that's where the rubber meets the road. He's talking about self-control and the judgment to come. And I think that sums it up so well. No wonder Felix became very, very, you know, convicted and frightened. And he said, well, I'll listen to you another day. But then the guy, he's just like Herod, that ended up having John the Baptist's head cut off. He summons Paul because he thinks, hey, Paul, he's a Roman citizen. He must have money, or at least he's a head of his church, which must have money. So he's thinking he's going to get a bribe. It's such a typical politician. To me, it's typical. Godless people who have no conviction to do the right thing. It's only to do the things for the people who are going to give them money. Well, Felix is no different. He's, to me, a consummate politician, thinking, well, I'm going to get something out of Paul. But it doesn't happen. So he leaves him there languishing for 2 years. I mean, the guy's worthless. He's a typical politician, as far as I'm concerned. So when he gets relieved of his post, apparently Rome found out that this guy is not doing his job correctly, and they relieved him of his job. So he had to go back from Rome or whatever. But what he did is he just simply, left Paul in prison. So he was a man without any, you know, conscience, any conviction, just simply doing the expedient thing to make himself look good. So if all I'm gracious, I ate myself to the Jews, make them look good. Well, how many people do that today? Nothing's changed, has it? 2,000 years have come and gone, nothing's changed. Well, I can guarantee you, I can't guarantee you, but I'd be willing to bet that Felix is not in heaven today. And it's not because of his rejection of the truth. It's just simply his unwillingness to accept the truth. Okay, he put it off, he, you know, and simply figured that, Well, I'll listen to this another time. See, this is exactly what Herod did. When he had John the Baptist in prison, it says that Herod used to like to go down to the prison and talk to John. He liked to listen to John because John was just filled with the Holy Spirit. And what he was saying was he could see the wisdom and the spiritual authority, the divine authority there. But it didn't change him. It didn't change him. So when push came to shove, and he was in an adulterous relationship with his brother's wife, and then his brother's wife asked for John the Baptist's head in order to save himself, save face politically, what does he do? When the chips were down, he takes off John the Baptist's head. Same thing with Felix. He knew what Paul was saying was the truth because he was frightened. He was convicted. But when the chips were down, what did he do? He sold Paul out, to make himself look good for these other people. So I'm telling you, hey, man, the Bible says again and again, today is the day of salvation. It's like when God puts you under conviction and your spirit under conviction, whatever, the worst thing you could do, as far as I'm concerned, is to put it off, procrastinate. Sometimes it's better just to flat out reject it. Because if you flat out reject it, there's a good chance that you may come around again. But if you put it off, then you're in a real bad position because you haven't rejected it outright. So you're just saying, well, I'll get around to it someday. Mm-hmm. But the Bible says today is the day of salvation. Anybody have anything you want to add or share to what we read tonight?
Yeah, John, you said that Felix didn't reject him. But in the Bible, doesn't it say, if you are not for me, you are against me?
Exactly, exactly. It's true. I mean, in God's eyes, there's a rejection there. There's no doubt about it. If you're not with me, you're against me. If you're not gathering with me, if you're not working with me, you're scattering against me. Mm-hmm. People often have this misconception that, well, I'm not opposed to Christ, and I'm not out there, attacking him. Therefore, I must be for him. No, if you're not out there gathering with him, if you're not out there actively promoting his kingdom and his will in your life and in other people's life, then you're opposed to him, and you're working against him.